Of all the anthropomorphic images used to describe God in the Torah, one of the most richly developed is the hand of God. The image appears for the first time in the book of Exodus and is then reworked and nuanced in various ways throughout the rest of that book. Here, in the book of Deuteronomy, in Parshat Ekev, Moshe will draw on several of those earlier images in order to frame a new religious message for the people about to cross over into the land. Moshe employs the image of God's hand early on in our parsha as he attempts to rouse the courage of those heading over to do battle against the Canaanites. Lo tira mehem, do not fear them. Zachor tizkor, remember, you must remember what the Eternal your God did to Pharaoh and to all of Egypt. The wondrous acts that you saw with your own eyes, the signs and the wonders. V'hayad achazaka v'hasrua nituya, the mighty hand and the outstretched arm with which the Eternal your God liberated you. The language and context here echo the Torah's very first reference to God's hand, which appeared in God's message to Moshe at the burning bush. Vani yadati, and I know that the king of Egypt will not let you go without a mighty hand. So I will send forth my hand and strike Egypt with all the wonders I will perform there. And after this, he will send them out. The primary association with God's hand, then, is the awesome power of God in the deliverance of the children of Israel from Egypt, especially as demonstrated in the form of miraculous wonders. And the primary adjective that will describe the work of that hand is chazaka, mighty. Here in Deuteronomy, decades later, Moshe combines that mighty hand with another image taken from Exodus, the outstretched arm, zrua netuya, with which God promised to redeem the children of Israel. The combination of the two gives us the full classic phrase, a mighty hand and an outstretched arm, that will form the beginning of the story of the Exodus told in the Passover Haggadah. Taken together, the two phrases represent both power and reach, the magnitude of God's capability, and the extent of God's concern. Later in our parsha, however, Moshe recalls another image of the divine hand, but one that suggests a much smaller scale of activity. When Moshe describes going up on Mount Sinai to receive the tablets engraved with the Ten Commandments, he says, Vayiten Hashem elai et shnei luchot ha'avanim k'tuvim be'etzba Elokim. The Eternal gave me the two tablets of stone, inscribed by the finger of God. This phrase is also drawn from Exodus, from the account of the giving of the first tablets of the Ten Commandments on Mount Sinai. But the meaning of this image is not as clearly articulated. Why zoom in on the finger of God when it comes to the tablets? Why not use the more standard term and say they were inscribed with the hand of God, Ktav Yado? We write with our whole hand, after all, not just one finger. If God's hand represents might, what does God's finger represent? We can gain some insight by turning to the one other place in the Torah where this image is used. It appears also in the book of Exodus, but long before the tablets are given. It comes in the wake of the third of the 10 plagues, lice. In response to the infestation, Pharaoh's magicians declare, Etzba Elokim hi, it is the finger of God. Why do Pharaoh's magicians use this image? The context here is important. After the first two plagues, blood and frogs, as soon as Moshe and Aaron unleash the plague, Pharaoh's magicians respond by producing the same phenomenon with their own sorcery, in order to demonstrate that there's nothing special about the power of the God of Israel. But when it comes to the third plague, lice, the magicians are suddenly unable to replicate it. Rashi, borrowing from the Talmud, gives an explanation for this unique feature of the plague of lice. V'lo yachlu, they could not, because dark forces have no power over something smaller than a barley corn. Pharaoh's magicians were unable to recreate lice, not because of the magnitude of power demonstrated by this plague, but rather precisely because these creatures were so small, they fell beyond the clumsy reach of magicians' powers. Smaller than a barley corn is like an ancient way of saying quantum. The reference to the finger of God, then, indicates that this plague demonstrated intricate, precise creation, the work of dexterous fingers, rather than the big stroke of an arm or a hand. The plague of lice took place on a microscopic scale, and therefore demonstrated that God's power operates not only at the cosmic level, but also at the atomic. When that image is applied to the inscribing of the commandments, it suggests that there is something intricate and precise about the mechanics of God's law as well. Anyone who has studied halakha, the Jewish legal system, knows this to be true. The Torah itself contains hundreds of commandments that cover every area of life, from prayer to property, from going to war to going to the bathroom. The rabbinic project of carefully mapping those laws onto every aspect of human life are recorded in the famously hair-splitting discussions that make up the Talmud. The subsequent work of the poskim, the legal scholars in every generation, to continuously reapply the law in light of new circumstances and technologies, has left a record of detailed reflections on the law that could fill many libraries. The study and practice of Jewish law, in all its particulars, represents a proposition that the divine encounter can be had not just in the breathtaking handiwork of God's creation, or in the mighty arm of God's salvation, but also in the granular details of every action, in the minutiae, in the mundane, in the minuscule tasks of everyday life. There, too, we might detect God's fingerprints. Why, then, here in Parshat Ekev, does Moshe summon both of these images, the mighty hand and outstretched arm, and the finger of God, as he looks out across the Jordan and speaks to those who will soon cross it? He is speaking to two phases of the journey ahead, and two different relationships to God that each will call forth. In the near future, they will be at war, they will be in unfamiliar territory, and their lives will be at great risk. They are, understandably, very afraid. To prepare them for this challenge, Moshe wants to remind them of the God whose wonders he witnessed in Egypt, the all-powerful God who hears the cries of the suffering, who performs miracles and brings salvation in the face of seemingly insurmountable forces of destruction, the God with the mighty hand. One day, however, when all the fighting is over, the real mission of these people is to build a peaceful, thriving society governed by principles of justice and order. But when that day comes, they will need to discover a different relationship to God. For there will not always be fire streaming down from the heavens and seas splitting in two. God will not always come down into the world so thunderously and intervene with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. The children of Israel will one day need to know how to look for God in the quotidian reality of everyday life. For that they have the commandments, which are meant to infuse their lives with holiness. Yet it can be easy to miss the presence of God in the performance of the commandments, especially in the ongoing routine of daily practice. One can get lost in all the details of halakha and lose sight of the covenant that lies behind it, and of the God that is on the other end of that covenant. So Moshe offers the people another image to contemplate, the finger of God that worked nimbly to carve out the letters of the law. This finger belongs to a God who cares and gives attention not only about the terrible trials and the majestic triumphs of our lives, but also about the quieter, less conspicuous moments in our existence. There too, Moshe tells the people, speaking to their future selves, there too our God will be found. May we too feel ourselves protected by God's mighty hand and outstretched arm as we face the terrible dangers ahead. And may we, one day soon, once again know quieter days, and discover in them a gentler, more regular contact with God. May we merit the peace it takes to be able to attend to the tiny concerns of our little lives, and to find God there, hidden in the details.